In the 1760s, Josiah Wedgwood was instrumental in adapting the Rose and Crown lathe for use in shaping and decorating earthenware. The most obvious results of this invention can be found with dipped wares, where the surface application of colored slip is inlaid, as with these, or as mechanized graffito, where the decoration is cut through the slip to reveal the body color.
I'm Jonathan Rickard. I've collected and written about and studied mocha, or dipped wares, for nearly 30 years. The processes of manufacture have eluded me until I met Don Carpentier.
It'd be interesting to see what Dean Lynn Roberts thinks of all this.
Don is a self-taught potter and master of Eastfield Village, where we are today. He has now developed an engine turning lathe. It's the only one working in North America for pottery usage. And by working on that lathe, we've discovered how so many of the different processes were accomplished. I think you'll enjoy this.
Okay, this is basically a copy of Wedgwood's 1768 design for an engine lathe. He started this process by buying a copy of a French lathe designed by a fellow named Plumier in the early 18th century, and they were being made in Birmingham, England in the 1760s. And he had several of them that he'd gotten in Birmingham, but he decided in 1768 he wanted to change the design. Initially, the French lathes had these cams. This is a crown cam. This is an edge cam. They were all set in here where this wooden pulley is now, and there were no cams at the ends. Well, he decided he'd put the cams at the outside end, because before you had to take the entire lathe apart to get these cams out. So now, since these are the business that actually makes the patterns of these cams, he was able to put them on the ends and take them off whenever he wanted to without dismantling the whole lathe. It sped the process up and made life a whole lot easier. And as far as I know, he's the first one to actually develop a lathe like this. So the original is still in the collection at Barlaston at the Wedgwood Museum. They have two copies of it that they made in the 20th century, and this basically is another copy of this lathe, and I use it here to do research with. The other difference is that these cams have a pattern. This has the edge cams have a pattern just on the outside edge. The crown cam has the pattern on the side. And the French lathes, they're very thick cams, and they have a pattern on the outside edge and on the inside edge. So there are two cams combined into one in the French lathe. And on this one, you have two separate cams that you can take off whenever you want to and independently of one another. Now, in 1768, he found a local machinist or engineer in the Potteries District who was willing to build this thing for him. And he specifically talks about having a spring that could act in either direction. You can make the spring work push this way, you can make the spring push this way with these two separate levers. And that will put, you can have a double-sided cam, so you can have action on this side or on this side, but you need to switch the direction the spring is working. That was one of his inventions. And like I said, the other thing was to have this piece on both sides, or have a cam on this end and a cam on that end. So what we have at the end is a crown cam, and that allows this entire shaft on this lathe to move back and forth against the shapes that you put on the edge of this cam. Now that you have to lift this little handle, and that actually allows this whole thing to move back and forth. against a series of springs. There's a spring here that can push this way or push back this way, depending on which side of this disc you have the cam on. And then you have another cam over here, which is called an edge cam, and they come in a lot of different forms. This particular edge cam is used for doing basket weave. It's got identical patterns on both cams, but they're set half a pattern apart, so that you can actually make a basket weave by using one cam, doing alternate rows, and then switching to the other cam and filling in the rows in between. The other thing that we see lots of in the period is something like this. This is known as a checkering cam. And again, they're two identical cams, the exact same pattern cut into the outside, and they're half a pattern apart. Curve is in the middle of this one. See that? At this point, you will literally get checkering from this cam, which is something they did lots of back then. And these cams all slide on. You unscrew this mandrel at the end, and you slide the cams on, and they get locked on. There's a keyway that keeps them from spinning, so they're always locked in the exact same spot, and it ends up allowing you to make any kinds of patterns, but you do need to plan in advance. This isn't something you can do kind of freehand. You have to think in advance what you're going to do. Do you want a lathe that has checkering on it? Do you want a lathe that has certain type of bars? You not only have to make the cams, but then you have to make a series of tools that go with these cams. And these tools have all sorts of different cuts in them. You can have cams that do a lot of different things, and all the patterns are different on the end. There's another knife. These happen to be made out of old high-speed tool steel hacksaw blades. And it's very, very, very good steel. It lasts a long time. And I make all my blades, and they actually did too. They took scrap steel and they did the same thing. So you might be able to use one cam with 20 or 30 different knives. If you change the knife, you still get a different pattern even using the same cam. And you're going to see some of that today while we work on these things. So some of the other major parts of this lathe would be the mandrel right here that you actually put the mug or the body. This is for mugs. You'd actually slide the mug onto this and it would hold it while you're cutting. And you've got to remember, in the early days you had a tool rest that would go into this piece right here, and some of the early ones had a series of holes drilled across here. You'd set your tools on it and an iron bar would come down on top and lock the tools into place so they couldn't move from the pressure of the lathe going around. I do what they do at Wedgwood now, and I use a magnetic chuck that they use in a lot of the machine tool industry. And when you turn this little lever, it brings the magnets into close contact with either side. You can actually set the tool right there. See, it actually has to be, if it's balanced, it stays just fine. But the tool stays still. This tool is never going to move. It stays still, and the pot actually turns into it. So if we lift up this locking arm prevents the center axle of this lathe from moving back and forth like this. This lathe is hinged so it can go front to back, and then there are springs that allow it to go end to end. Right now I'm going to lock in the mechanism that keeps it from going end to end and just make this go around a little bit. And if you look carefully in here, you'll actually see the mandrel being pushed away from the tools. I don't know if you can see that or not. You can actually see it being pushed away. And if you back up a little bit and look over here, there's an item called a follower. This is the edge cam. This little wheel here was called in the early days a tuticle. And on metal cutting engine lathes, it was called a rubber. And on this type of lathe, that's called a follower. And it's actually a small wheel, and it follows the entire shape all the way around of this edge cam. And there's a series of springs up here on the front. This is one of the springs. And the thumb screw that actually makes it work, it'll actually flex. There's actually flexing going on right in here as I turn the thumb screw, and it puts tension on, and this rod that goes to the center of the lathe actually allows the tension to work against it. And there's another spring back here. These two work together to pull the lathe, the rocking motion that's from front to back that this lathe is capable of. And if I were to take up this particular locking device here, you'll see that this lathe can be moved inside and out this way on springs. So this lathe has a pumping motion back and forth this way and a rocking motion back front to back. There's pressure always in this direction on this particular cam right now, and that allows this little wheel to constantly follow the cam. If you can see that, it never gets pushed away. I mean, it never comes loose. If it follows it carefully all the way around, it gives you a perfect crisp design. So if you can see, as you hit a high spot here, as you hit the high part of the lobe, you get pushed farthest away. So that will give you the least amount of cut as you work your way around. And this has to move pretty slowly because you set up a lot of vibration by this thing hitting into the follower over and over again. No matter how smoothly that works, it still hits into the follower. And originally you'd have a large flywheel down below that somebody would actually pull ever so carefully and slowly, and there'd be someone turning this by hand while you were actually working on the lathe over here. And for just convenience, since I don't have somebody else to turn this for me, I put a modern motor on that actually can slow down and speed up the way I need it. The other thing that we can do right now is to lock this in place and lift up. This is the lock that prevents the shaft from going side to side. And if we can find a wrench around here it is, we can actually bring this follower, which I'll take off and show you. There's another follower. See, it's a large wheel, and that wheel actually follows the side of this crown cam. There are a lot of different patterns that you can use on a crown cam. This one is for doing kind of a zigzag sawtooth cut on the side of a pot. And right now we have one on that actually cuts grooves in the side of the body of a mug or a pot, and that you can inlay with color. And that's what we'll be doing next. So what I need to do now is line up the low spot in the cam and slide it over so that I'm just slightly away from the stops on the main shaft of the lathe. Lock the follower in place. And if you watch carefully in here, you'll actually see this whole thing moving back and forth. You can see it, you'll probably see it best in there. You can see the entire lathe moving away. These actually, they look very broad and shallow, but the depth always remains the same. But as you get to a smaller article inside here, that becomes a very much of an arch. But it expands as you get out farther and farther and farther away from the center. So you get a smaller arch in here, but the same height when you get partway into where the mug body actually is. And you'll see that as we cut it. So what I'll do is I'll lock the follower in at the low spot. Now that's making this entire shaft move in and out. And you can see on the tool as it moves around. And once we start cutting with it, it's actually going to give you a series of arches all the way around this pot. It's a very nice smooth action, actually. So we'll be making one of these. The next thing we do, actually, now that we're set up, we can actually make one of these mugs next.
Potteries of Staffordshire and other potting centers maintained pattern books as well as shape books. Few pattern books survive, with only the Leeds New Teapot Drawing Book and the Leeds Drawing Book for Blackware of 1806 having engine-turned patterns. Don has used surviving pots for the patterns on his initial experiments.
Clean the surface so I can put the color on it.
Colored slip is applied over the engine-turned patterns and allowed to dry. In the drying process, Much of the water in the slip is absorbed by the pot body, ensuring that the slip decoration will not flake off. The color of slip changes when fired, so Don has labored over formulating colors that, when fired, appear the same as those on the early pots. Once the moisture is fully absorbed, the excess slip is shaved away on a normal turning lathe, revealing slip only in the recessed pattern. Some potters found an intriguing use for the shaved-off slip, but that's another story. Using a special tool, or a rouletting wheel, the turner may impress a pattern, which will either be inlaid with slip or tinted in the glaze. Here, the finished pot is shown just before the biscuit firing. Then it would be dipped in the glaze material and fired a second time. This example has already been banded with two colors of slip, as well as with a rouletting wheel. Using the edge cam, which in nearly all cases provides an interrupted pattern, and with the use of two cutting tools, one V-shaped, we'll see the process of cutting through the slip to reveal the body color.
Now what I do is cut out the bands. That one. Thank you. is we're going to cut alternating bands like this, and they'll cut the white away, cut away at the black so we have white, okay? And we're going to do that with half of this cam.
The original Turners used slip cups with hollow goose quills. Don makes use of modern squeeze bottles, storing his array of slip colors in them. With this example, the engine-turned aspect is secondary to the multiple bands of colored slip, but the design would lose its vitality without the bold vertical bands.
Well, it's going to be dark blue at some point.
Here's the earliest known engine-turn dipped mug. Don makes his version of it as yet another exercise in mastering the process.
We've done alternating bands. Now it's time to go back and flip the cam, fall over to the other side. Now we're working off the alternate cam that's half a pattern away. And we should, if all things work,
be able to cut checkers in between.
This is the most complex pattern Don has attempted, based on a bowl in his collection, with the impressed mark.